Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 131. We're talking with Greg Lehman this week about all things related to movements of the lower back during exercise, low back pain risk reduction, treatment, etc. If you're unfamiliar with who Greg Lehman is, he's going to give himself an introduction here very shortly. But he's worked with Dr. McGill. He has studied low back movement during exercise extensively, and also how that correlates to pain. He's also a chiropractor and a physical therapist, so more on that when we begin the podcast here shortly. A few announcements first. This Friday, we've got two new templates dropping. One is for the Army Combat Fitness Test, so if you have that coming up and you're wondering how should I train, how should I structure my training in order to get ready for that test, we've got that. Or if you have a friend, family member, somebody else who's getting ready for that test and is not really sure how to train for it, we've got a resource for you. And we also have our new Strongman template coming out. Alan Thrall and I collaborated on that, and pretty excited to bring that to you. We'll have a podcast with Alan on the creation of that specific template coming out next Monday, so you have that to look forward to. And we have a new newsletter dropping this week, so if you're not subscribed to our newsletter, head over to our website, barbellmedicine.com, and sign up for that. It's not a marketing email. It's just new information that we don't publish anywhere else. And if you're interested in that, well, sign up for the newsletter. All right, let's hop into this week's podcast with Greg Lehman.
So it's Greg Lehman. I'm out of Toronto, Canada. I'm a physio, and I was a chiro, but not anymore. I let that license slide.
Wait, did you went to chiropractic school first?
Yeah.
And then like
a master's in spine biomechanics first. On like exercise biomechanics and chiropractic manipulation or spine manipulation. And then I went to Cairo College, and they were great because I got to do research there, but I didn't buy into the traditional Cairo model. So didn't really feel like I fit in. There's a lot of good people in it. And then I went back to school for physio, which was more pragmatic. It just lets me, you know, practice anywhere in the world. It's just a license, right?
Sure. Sorry, was there a gap? Like, did you go straight from chiropractic school to
PT school? Oh, yeah. So I was in clinical practice for 5 years straight after graduating chiro. And then because physio school was like just down the road, literally from where I practiced my little clinic, I could go and keep practicing and seeing patients and go to school. Because they weren't trying to beat physio training in Canada is pretty good. Like they don't try to beat you over the head or and give you a massive volume of material. It's actually, this is what you need to know. It's only 2 years. Who's excellent.
Your background is super interesting, obviously, in that you're somewhat unique, having, I guess, come at this same issue from multiple different angles, meaning that you've looked at, be it pain and or the, you know, the role of mechanics, but also back pain in particular, which we were hoping to talk to you about. You've been kind of educated or trained on the topic, viewing it through three different lenses, I suppose, which had to have been kind of interesting to see some similarities and differences across them. And that's a big part of why we wanted to, you know, chat with you about it and why we've, you know, been interested and I've learned from your stuff in the past as well. I think it's been super helpful for what we do and the message we try to get out there as well.
Yeah, my training's been interesting, but it's still North America. So it's really dominated by like one or two schools of thoughts. So like, I still feel like there's other avenues I can explore. Like there's so much out there. Pain's so complicated. You guys know this. The more you're in practice, the more humble you should feel.
Yeah, that's been my exact proportionality to like confidence in speaking about like just pain in the experience. Because you remember you going through like I said, neuroanatomy, and you're like, oh, man, if it wasn't for these pain fibers, we'd be good.
Just and cut these out.
Yeah, you just cut them out, and then you're like, there might be some additional nuance, and then you start going down that rabbit hole, and then next thing you know, you're reading a philosophy book, and you're like, what even is life? Like, what are we? And I say that tongue in cheek, but if you know any of the listeners have listened to our pain and rehab team's podcast, you understand like that's the natural progression of things, and then
I'm curious a bit because you mentioned some of the research you've done in the past, just to further flesh out some of the, I guess, credentials and perhaps biases and other things that you may bring to the table. Could you tell us a bit more about some of the research topics you've looked into? If I recall, you know, you've also worked with or under, Dr. McGill before, who I know is obviously another big name that we hear dropped in this conversation a lot and things like that.
Yeah, so I was lucky to do my master's at Waterloo, and my supervisor was Professor McGill. And I worked with him mainly. So my research was like the biomechanics of manipulation, but then a lot of exercise biomechanics stuff, which was fun, primarily EMG, not Stu's model, which is excellent. I'm more of like, all of my research studies are super simple and very like low level stuff. They're not complicated. They're the research papers that people have these questions all of the time, but you're never going to get funding for it. You know, so 15 years ago, it was like, should I do my bench press on a stability ball? Should I do calf raises on a Bosu or a wobble board? You know what I mean? Like those things people would say, or like, what's the best way to train the core? Can I get a core workout by doing deadlifts? Or can I get a core workout by doing heavy squats or jumping or plyometrics? So I love those questions. They're not really hard to answer with some like with EMG, but they'll never get funding. So I'm not like a real fantastic biomechanical researcher by any stretch, but I have a massive respect for that area. So I read a ton of it and I've always been good at that. That's sort of my strength is reading from a lot of different people and having enough of a knowledge base to understand what's going on without being able to recreate it myself.
Awesome. And then your current body of work, like you're calling it movement optimism, which I love. I noticed that was your email, like that's your business. That's your, how did that come to be? And like, what are you actively doing through that?
So that's my shtick. That's like in school, you know, or the dominant model in North America is like find some dysfunction or something wrong with someone. And that basically is someone doesn't move the way we think that they should move, usually outside neutral. So your knee caves in into valgus, your foot pronates, your spine laterally deviates or flexes a lot. Aha, that's why you have pain. And to me, that's such a simplistic way of looking at it. Not only is it inconsistent with how pain works, I think it's actually inconsistent with how biomechanics works, right? Like, I don't think pain science challenges biomechanics. I think it's biomechanics that challenges biomechanics. There's just another way to view the body, and that's the idea of movement optimism. Like, we're built to get in these weird positions. You can tolerate it. That's what we do. We adapt. So that's the movement optimistic take.
It's like a choir of angels to my ears here, you know, just hearing this.
It's not that biomechanics doesn't matter. Like if I do tons of gymnastics and if I'm jumping off of something high, there's a better way to land. Like there's an optimal. So high loads or things like that. Or if you're doing a deadlift, like if you slip and trip, yeah, there's a better way to fall, you know, like, so those high loads, that shit matters, but like low level stuff under control, it seems to matter less. Or for performance. Yeah, there's a better way. No one's going to do a max deadlift with a Jefferson style lift, right?
It's right, not on purpose. Yeah. No, there's definitely like an efficiency sort of like bent to like biomechanics from a performance standpoint.
Yeah.
But like from a, if you're just thinking like evolutionarily, we're here to, you know, reproduce and pass on our genes. And so we ideal, you know, we should be resilient and tolerant of a whole bunch of different positions that just allow us to interact with our environment and, you know, to suggest that individual positions or mechanics are quote unquote bad or harmful or the source, not only as simplistic, but probably not compatible with like, you know, passing on our genes in a very diverse environment that, you know, is ever changing. In addition to like the fact that we can adapt to, well, damn near anything, as far as we figured out, you know, like we don't know the upper limit of like, actually, this is it. You can't above this, you can't really adapt to it, you know, provided that the load is meted out appropriately, at least as far as we understand it. This, you know, 100 years from now, this is going to age terribly. They'll be like, actually, we figured it out. Yeah. And that was that was all wrong.
A big part of, you know, what we talk about and try to get out there is kind of public health advice recommendations, getting more people to be more physically active, and in particular to engage with resistance training as a component of their exercise programs, in particular for like healthy aging. In my clinical kind of world, I do inpatient medicine, see tons of frailty, sarcopenia, people who are unable to stand up off of a chair, get out of bed, take care of themselves, and they end up institutionalized in nursing homes, developing pressure ulcers, all these like horrific complications that see every day. And so one of the big things that we see is whether people are experiencing pain or not, a lot of these conversations around things like, putting humans under load in the course of exercise, there is this constant emphasis on, you know, perfect movement, the neutral that you were talking about, deviations from which are to be avoided almost at all costs. And there is this kind of assigned threat value to that thing that really seems to resonate with people quite a bit. And, you know, we see it as a pretty significant barrier to people buying in and engaging, because there's a innate kind of baked in fear of things like that because of things they've been told from people who they view as being in positions of authority. So that's kind of like, you know, we recognize the platform we have for this, and we can push back against that. It is quite difficult, particularly when there are, you know, folks with substantially larger followings, whether in the lay media or in like social media, in the fitness sphere, who can put out like pithy little lines or videos with like a red X on it showing that you shouldn't move this particular way. So that's why we've been hammering on this stuff for like years now. And it's hard to feel like we're making progress, but at least in our audience, we start to see more uptake and them helping us kind of spread the message. So we're glad to have you around to talk about this stuff a little bit more, and definitely the movement optimism idea versus what I know you contrast it with, the kinesiopathological model, just like wrong movement, localizing the lesion of movement, as you know, we're trained in medicine, say you have a symptom, we have to like localize the lesion, find out where the problem is. And that's a lot more complicated kind of when it comes to pain.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you talk about spinal flexion in life and under load, you know, you kind of got into a little bit as far as its relevance or lack thereof, or the context in which it may have some relevance for pain. But you did mention that you're very well read on a lot of these topics. Could you give us and the listeners a sense of where you view the current evidence and the limitations of the available evidence on that topic? It's a big one, I know.
Yeah. So to simplify it, the question would be, you know, is spine flexion an independent risk factor for low back pain? Right. So if you took a group of 100 people and compared them to another group of 100, and they both lifted the same amount, they had all the same psychosocial stressors, they trained the same, you know, everything was the same, except one group was taught to lift with their hips and they let their spine round, I don't know, 80% of max or more. And the other group lifted with their hips and they tried to maintain their spine in as much neutral as they could, or less flexed. Is that group who avoids 80 to 100% max flexion, are they less likely to get injured? That right there, that's the question. And I'm very specific about saying like 80 to 60% max flexion, because when you look at the spine kinematic research, if you're doing a deadlift or if you're lifting from the floor, I would say most people, even if it looks like they're not flexing a lot, they're flexing at least 60 to 80% of their max. That's the big thing. And that's well established when people measure lumbar spine. And so I remember reading the cadaver research from decades ago, specifically Jack Callahan's work. Jack showed this, that you can create a disc herniation with highly repetitive spinal flexion in a cadaver model. And what always threw me for a loop when I went back, and read that was how little spine flexion Jack actually put the motion segment through. I mean, Jack, we talked about this, but he only put it through 35% of the motion segment's max. I don't know if it was a real max or if it was like super maximal, but it wasn't maximal motion. That's the big thing. It wasn't end range flexion. And I thought, okay, in order for a risk factor to be actionable, yeah, it didn't go all the way. Like, that's the thing. And other researchers have done the same thing. They did not go end range flexion, right? It was not end range flexion. And they said, aha, if you do lots of end range flexion, this is what people said, you're going to get injured. But all these cadaver studies didn't go to end range. And I'm like, okay, if that's really true, if that amount of flexion, whatever it happened to be, 30 to 80% flexion, if that's really a risk factor for disc injury, are we able to avoid it? Because I thought, okay, I found the risk factor for shoulder pain. It's breathing. I'm like, fuck, I have to breathe. I'm doomed, right? And that's sort of what I thought about spine flexion. I'm like, if Jack only bent it a little bit, 35 to 60% or 70% or 80%, how often are we actually able to avoid it? And I'm not sure we can. So to me, I'm like, I don't think it matters, because I think life is bending your spine more than 70%. I don't know.
Yeah. So for the listeners at home, you know, this whole idea of a neutral zone is that it's effectively the range of motion of your spine between points, either flexion or extension, where there's substantial contribution from like ligament, soft tissue, bony components, and muscle tension, you know, on either end. And as far as what range of flexion to extension that actually like occurs, that's a whole nother podcast. We could like really go down the biomechanics there. But what Greg is saying is that to the extent that it's been measured that you can, you know, do repetitive flexion, we're probably, and cause a herniation, we're probably in excess of that in not only our activities of daily life, but certainly just exercise, anything that requires use of your lower extremities. So like every deadlift that you ever do, whether your back is flat, rounded, or an overextension, you're out of this quote unquote zone that's been tested in cadavers. And so if you can't avoid that range of motion, is it really an independent risk factor? Because you're doing it all the time anyway. So what you're saying is that, yeah, movement and being alive, cyclical respiration of oxygen and carbon dioxide may be the independent risk factor here for this low back pain. So do you think there's a better definition for like this neutral zone if you were playing devil's advocate?
Yeah. So what I would say is, Tyson Beach is a great researcher to talk about this, and hopefully Tyson and I are going to do some more research on this. I think, so the neutral zone is where you start to get resistance to movement, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think in the intact lumbar spine, it's somewhere between 60 and 80%.
So further out, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it seems. And that's consistent with someone like Patricia Dolan, her research from decades ago. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, we say this, everything we're saying, she said 20 years ago. She's like, you can't squat and not bend your spine. But she thinks you can, and most people would agree with this, if you bend your spine 90% of its max or 100% of its max, you could probably take it down to 80 or 70. You can do things like that.
So what you're saying is that with like our own volitional effort, that is the extent to which we can modify this degree of spinal flexion during movement. And to contrast that with maybe the lay understanding or the understanding of maybe strength coaches who might feel that if I cue you and smack you and yell at you enough, when you're setting up your movement, that we could get you volitionally down to like 0% spinal flexion, which is completely unlikely to be the case. Is that fair to say?
Only if you're standing upright.
Right.
But if you do a good morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you do a good morning, like a really strict good morning, this is Andrew Vygotsky's work, you're going to get 20 degrees of lumbar spine flexion, which is probably around 40 to 50% of max. Tyson did a study where he had people lift something from the floor, and he was able to, with good cueing, and he's a good coach too, he's able to modify flexion 7 degrees. So they probably, which is probably about 14 to 20% of max.
Yeah. And so just for coaching, because we coach people, we teach people how to lift all the time. And there are lots of coaches listening to this who might say, no, I am a coach who, when I cue people, their back looks flat. And like, I keep coming back to this because I really want the message to sink in. It's like, even when it looks flat, they are flexing the actual the vertebrae themselves relative to the maximum amount of flexion that they can do. They're flexing a substantial amount when you have somebody bent over, set up to pick something up off the floor.
So can I comment on like what they're probably seeing, what I think here? So,
of course.
That's what he asked me to do. So the way people typically measure lumbar flexion is you put a sensor on T12 and one on S1. And you only really get the difference between those. So it's full lumbar flexion. I've fooled around with these sensors. And if you put it on L2 and then S1, you're going to get less total flexion when you try to do it. And what people do when they minimize spine flexion, when it looks like there's less, I think most of it, and you guys know this, it's in the thoracic spine. It's an illusion, right? You're really moving the upper lumbar spine. That lower lumbar spine, like S1, L5, L4, where everyone thinks disc herniations occur, that's still flexing a lot. I don't know if it's flexing maximally, probably not, and for a deadlift, but it's still flexing a shit ton.
I like that. I like the quantification.
Yeah.
And so you've been playing around with these sensors. We've seen some videos of you applying these sensors to yourself and setting up and squatting and deadlifting at home yourself with, more or less kind of volitional spinal flexion or extension to the extent you can control it. And so what kind of numbers are you seeing just so people have a sense of, this in the real world?
So if I do a relaxed deadlift where I feel comfortable, where my back doesn't hurt, and I'm not trying to round my back, it's not a Jefferson, but I'm not actively arching the hell out of it, I'll get like 70 to 80% of max flexion. If I do a Jefferson curl, I get 102% max flexion. If I arch the hell out of my spine, I might get, 55 to 60% max flexion. So it's totally, and I've repeated every day for like 10 days. It's totally consistent with the literature.
Just you're repeating it day after day for not only reliability, but to see if you get better.
Oh, that's the problem with this stuff too. Like even you get differences day to day, just changing the sensor position a little bit, you'll get different values. Like, yeah, you gotta be really strict when you do this stuff. So you can definitely change it. So that I guess the debate more should be, because this might be worthwhile investigating, is lifting heavy loads at 100% max flexion more injurious than lifting at 80% max flexion? No one's really tested that. There could be something there, because you are shifting where the stress goes, and I don't know. There could be something there. I'm open to that as devil's advocate.
This is assuming that under max loads, you have a choice, regardless of like your movement strategy goals and like, whatever somebody else is saying to you. Because I think, when we were on Twitter, so this is how Greg and I met, was on the Twitter. We were discussing something related to this topic. And then we talked about golf and then, a bromance was born. but the idea that like I have a choice at what my back is doing at a true 1RM seems unlikely to me. Now I understand that my training leading up to that, could either prepare me better or worse. But my take is like, if the 1RM is going to happen in a particular way that's predictable, and I have an option to either prepare in a series of graded loading like exposures to that, I'd probably pick that rather than doing it substantially different, and then rolling the dice when it comes time to do a 1RM. That would all be that would suppose that there's maybe not an inherent risk to deadlifting challenging loads at like 90% of flexion compared to maybe the 75 or 80% that I could achieve with substantial effort and maybe technique revision. I don't know that that answer to that question exists. And that also presupposes that there's a substantial amount of back pain coming from disc related or, flexion related, things, which I think is probably misplaced in most cases, but
Yeah. You're stressing, like, that's the thing. So even if you go from 90 to 70% max flexion, or even if you could be in neutral, if your disc is herniated and there's damage, you're still stressing it under compression. There'll be tension back there. We had a study. This got approved. It got put on hold. We were doing a study where we were going to damage the disc and then put it into neutral and just compress it. And in dead humans, and see what happens to the disc material.
Oh, it's cadaver. I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I was like, who's going to approve this? Maybe they do it differently up in Canada.
I forgot Jeff's last name. But yeah, we got, I'm involved in a study where we're going to look at that. Or like the thing with the heavy load and lifting at 90%, and people say, oh, the cadaver model suggests it's injurious. But the thing is, those cadaver models, they do like at minimum 250 loading cycles and up to 1,000. And that's within, 2 to 4 hours. Like, how many times a week, if you're training heavy, would you ever do a weight that's 90% of your max? Like, how many total reps for 1 week?
Yeah. Few.
Right? Exactly.
Few. Very few. Yeah.
It just makes
it take a lifetime to get that much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's such an inconsistency here. And even McGill's great paper with the powerlifters with Yasik Cholowicki, I think it was 91 or 89. This is the famous one where they documented a spinal injury. Have you heard this story? Like, someone was lifting and he said he dropped the weight and said it hurt. He went on and kept lifting in that study, but when they went back and looked at the fluoroscopy so they could actually see how the motion segment was moving, most people would avoid 100% max flexion. They didn't say by how much, just a few degrees. But this one guy, when he hurt his back, he went over 100% flexion. So therefore the conclusion was, 100% max flexion is bad. But you could just say he just moved in a weird way. He hurt his back, so then something changed, and then his spine went to 100% max flexion. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's different ways to view that research.
Yeah, like that's how he ended up dealing with that particular experience to continue movement. He changed his mechanics in a way.
Well, just in the short term. So like the injury or the blip could have occurred, and then the spine moved to 100% max flexion.
Right.
You don't know the actual timeline there. It wasn't, he moved to 100% max flexion and then the pain occurred. We have no idea. Yeah. There's other ways to look at those studies. And even if he did move to 100% and that's what caused the injury, you could just say, well, he should have been doing that beforehand to prepare for it.
To prepare, yeah. So just round your back a little more and it'd be fine.
Yeah. You did something you weren't used to. No shit, you got injured.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of the way we frame it a lot of the time. And that example of the different way of looking at the same problem, is super common in people who work with people, clients, patients who are in pain. And I use, just when I'm teaching on this stuff, I use a super common example that people relate to, just imagining that you like rolled your ankle off a curb and then it hurts and you go into the physical therapy clinic and you're limping and they blame your like movement asymmetry because you're limping on one leg and that's why your ankle hurts. And then they like work with you until you stop limping. And then by the time you're done, your pain's gone and they pat themselves on the back that they fixed your movement asymmetry and now your ankle feels better. Whereas obviously the, directionality or the causality and things like that are not being interpreted correctly.
I'm laughing because I started a keynote with that the other day. And I said, we can learn from limping because somebody limps and that helps them get around and keep walking when they sprain their ankle.
Yeah.
But what we've done in the spine world is someone lifts with a neutral spine and they have less pain. So we've said, neutral is better. But we would never look at someone who's limping and say, that helps him walk. When he limps, he has less pain. Therefore, everyone else should be limping.
Right.
That's the right way to get around.
Yeah.
Because it's successful, but we've done it in the spine.
Yeah. The spine is viewed as being special, unique compared to a lot of other joints and stuff like that. But I swear I didn't steal my example from you.
No, I know. It's called, we're both like, you've got nothing original here. That's nothing.
Yeah, right. Most of your work with people, is it in a PT, like a rehabilitative setting? Or are you doing any performance coaching?
So I was a strength coach like 20 years ago where I worked with that was 10 years ago, like the Queens women's hockey team, and 20 years ago with the Laurier men's basketball team. But I haven't done that in a long time.
But
still, how I treat is primarily exercise and movement and activity and sport. So I'm not a coach anymore.
Right.
Just the principles.
Sure. Well, I mean, I just coach people online. So we could argue, like, am I really a coach or am I just, you know, data analyst? We don't know. No, the question I had for you is like, so if you had somebody in your clinic, in your gym in front of you, and you actively were seeing spinal motion during a squat or deadlift, particularly the lumbar segment moving, and now you're a woke clinician because you know all of the stuff and you have, you know, some ideas about what that actually means and relevance to not only efficiency, but also maybe injury risk, if any at all. Do you fix that? Are you concerned? Like, what's your take on that?
Yeah. So do they have pain?
They have no pain. They're you know, lifting. Yeah.
So, I mean, I still work with some people in the gym who just want to work out, you know?
Sure.
And if they're just learning, it's funny. I still actually try to teach the neutral-ish motion, but that's really just so people train their hips better. Like I would try to say focus on the spine just to get an emphasis on the glutes because they want to train their glutes for hockey or something like that.
Sure, sure.
Does that make sense? Like I think changing how people move, how they move is great for changing the stress on the body. And sometimes we want to get stress in certain areas. That's where biomechanics matters. So I wouldn't get too, it wouldn't be my, if they were just rounding their back doing a deadlift and not really, you know, squatting at all or having a knee flexion movement, then yeah, I'd teach the more traditional deadlift just to get the movement in the hips and the knees. Does that make sense? Or
yeah,
I think this is what I'm trying to stress.
It sounds like you're coming at it from like a performance minded standpoint where not only just the efficiency, but actually like, what is your target? Why are you doing this exercise in the first place? Like what,
that's it,
you know, movement patterns, what joint angles, you know, force production, et cetera, are you actually trying to target? And to the extent that the spine movement or any other movement is like detracting from, you know, the target or focus of that exercise, you would fix it to achieve
exactly
that goal.
Yeah.
But not like, oh shit, bro, you're about to snap your spine.
And honestly, well, that's why I don't stand behind them in case I get a disc in the face.
Right, right. Yeah. Safety first.
Or I guess it'd be laterally. Yeah.
So that's in the case of someone who doesn't have any like acute symptomology, meaning they can squat, they can deadlift, it's all pain-free, and you're just, you know, really trying to make sure they do the exercise to achieve the outcomes that you're looking for. Now, if someone did have pain, what's your strategy there? Let's say they have low back pain at the bottom of the squat and you're observing some visual flexion.
Because there's going to, and then let's say they also have pain during spinal flexion on the table or doing other things crunch. And if they haven't tried to avoid at all before, and they seem like they're an endurance coper, meaning they keep doing the thing over and over, I would totally be like, let's change up your technique or your squat depth or something just for a little bit. It's just a temporary avoidance. There's nothing wrong with what you're doing. You're just sensitive to it now. So let's not do it for a few weeks and then we'll slowly start doing it again. And then I would do the same thing the opposite way. If I thought they were too neutral or too arched, I like to flex my back a little when I squat with my baby weights.
Same.
You know, it feels better.
Well, that's the conversation Austin and I. Yeah. Well, that's the conversation Austin and I have mostly. We'll send each other like deadlift videos, which is mostly it's a low key competition. We're like, oh, how much weight's on the bar and how many reps are you doing it for? That's just how we keep each other in check. But usually it'll be a response like you should round your back a little more. You should flex your spine a little bit more and make it a little easier off the floor. Come on, man.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that you said you would go essentially both ways. If someone's sensitive to the flexion, then you would try to change that so they could tolerate the movement, versus if somebody is sensitive to it, maybe overextending or being too neutral as you might.
But sorry, I'm all excited now. But then sometimes, my back gets sometimes sensitive with lots of arching. Right? I do like to do back handsprings and stuff like that with the trampoline. And I'll actually switch my deadlift or squat and try to arch the hell out of my back to get more and do it every day as like a habit builder to get comfortable arching more, because I have to do it during the back handspring, and that's where it's bothering me. So then I'll use it as an exposure, not classic graded exposure. I'm not afraid of it, but more habituation concept or tissue preparation or something. I don't know. I don't know the mechanism. Sorry.
Yeah, you're preparing yourself for what you're trying to do, which is like the big overarching idea with respect to like managing injury risk and things like that. It's like, are you preparing to do what you're trying to do? And are you doing the thing that you've prepared for? And so commonly we'll hear like lifters and athletes who are like, oh yeah, there's always going to be some, you know, quote unquote form breakdown when you do a 1RM or something like that. But every other time besides that, you should always maintain perfect form. And it's like, well, doesn't sound like you're preparing necessarily for, you know, so maybe there's a different way to think about it. Yeah.
I have a potentially loaded question. If this is terrible, I'll edit it out. So don't worry. I feel like I'm balking at this. Well, so because you did study under McGill, and a lot of our listeners are familiar with McGill, either from where they came from before or other, you know, social media accounts or whatever. What's your take on the McGill, the big three, if you're familiar with it? It's a series of exercises that you should always do to reduce the risk of low back. I think I don't know if he claims low back injury versus low back pain, but yeah, what's your take on the big three?
Yeah, I mean, I was around when that was really getting popular in the 90s, and the reasoning seemed solid at the time. It was to get the most stress on the tissue with the least compression or shear. That was the idea. Slowly over time, you know, it changed to build stiffness and hence stability. I still use those exercises, but not for that reasoning. And that's the same thing with a lot of McGill stuff. I can learn a lot from him, but just for I have a different philosophy. So I had someone do the bird dog this morning, but I had them do it super arched. Like,
sure.
Because that's what they had trouble doing with their leg way up in the air. So because it's the move and preparation idea. So I kind of don't, that's where I would kind of disagree with the idea that everyone needs to do that and everyone needs to build stiffness in their spine so that it's stable under low load conditions. I think the spine must be stable. I just don't think it's something that anyone has to think of. I honestly think it's like breathing. Everyone needs to breathe, but I don't have to check in with my pons and see how my brainstem's doing. You know, it just happens. And that's where we can respect biomechanists. They've added to our understanding of how the spine works. They've described the phenomenon, but I'm not sure it's something that needs training, if that makes sense. Like, people can just walk. They don't need to post.
You're using those exercises just as exercises, not as some special recipe of things that, when combined, provide a unique benefit that perhaps couldn't be obtained through like almost any other, you know, many, many other kinds of exercises.
Yeah, that would be it's like the debate people have with the Copenhagens and the Nordic hamstring curls. They have evidence to help prevent injuries, but you might be able to get it through some other mechanism. And so with Ben Lee's work and Stu McGill, like they show that those isometrics were better than dynamic isotonic movements for creating spine stiffness, like passive stiffness. If that's your goal, maybe in a runner with a hip drop and you want to teach them to avoid it, then they might be helpful. But I don't think you need it for a healthy spine. It just depends what your goal is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the narrative out there, particularly amongst people who are not very familiar with the research and like the limitations of such and the actual specifics of the methodology, say that, well, no, you got to do these in order to maintain spine health or to generate spine health. If you have, you know, obviously using nebulous terms like spine health, you know, in the case, if you have low back pain or if you've ever had low back pain, it's like, they're probably just exercises, you know, with the specific adaptations being more or less useful to you, depending on what you're doing and what you want them to do. So,
yeah. It's certainly one road to help someone with low back pain and maybe help some people prevent it. It would be hard to say that you need a good study to compare it, those three exercises, with some other physical activity. And that's never been done.
Yeah, we've certainly seen a variety of experiences with those things. We had one client that I recall who was who came to us saying that he was doing those big three twice a day, every day for a year, and had made no improvement in his back pain. So that was a case where, you know, there was a lot of kind of work and conversations and things like that to do to get them to maybe recognize that this isn't really the cure for back pain. We might need to take a different approach, and it might have been just changing the exercises, doing something differently. Which, you know, I really like the way you describe, you know, what you would do with the folks who are in pain in your clinical situation, because it really helps to illustrate that this stuff doesn't need to be that complicated. You know what I mean? If something's hurting, they can change the way they're doing it temporarily, desensitize, you know, the person to the task and kind of work back towards it. But, you know, it doesn't have to be super difficult or super complicated.
Yeah, and the big three might help anywhere along those lines. They might help with the desensitizing. It might help with building back up.
Yeah.
And then at some point, they probably have to do more.
Yes.
Any specific back exercises that you think people need to avoid, Grit, that are just, you know, bad? I'm not trying to trap you, I promise. These are the hard-hitting questions.
I don't really think that way. I mean, nothing should be really avoided, but there's always a better use of your time. Mm-hmm. You know, like that, like I would much rather people do McGill's big three than the transverse abdominis, multifidus, that type of training or anything like that.
I think if people want to avoid low back pain, maybe they avoid, you know, high velocity trauma. Sure. to the extent that you can. And then
prepare for what you're trying to do.
Yeah, gradually increase physical activity to prepare for.
Yeah, I wouldn't prepare for a powerlifting meet by resting up for 2 weeks in bed. I can say that with certainty.
Well, there's
one.
that's the interesting. There's a one study that actually looked at powerlifting related injuries in a competition, right? And so they're just talking about like all these meets and where like people would self-report that they had an injury on the platform, like on competition day. There's one for Olympic weightlifting as well. In any case, what they described in some of the discussion was that they weren't aware of like the peaking and taper periods that individual athlete had obviously like undergone, and very common practices in some circles, in powerlifting in particular, is like, you do your last heavy workout like 3 weeks in advance and then like just kind of ride this wave. Now that's not what we advocate for, because we're like, you're just going to detrain.
Yeah.
And then by the time it actually comes time to like lift some heavy stuff, you know, when it matters, you might have, you know, put yourself at an elevated risk because you're deconditioned in a way, like to the extent, I mean, it's obviously variable on the individual, but I thought that was interesting that they had this data, but it's like, I really wish I'd known, like, is there a difference between the taper practices and then, you know, subsequent injury rate? Because I do think about that sometimes when people stop training or stop, you know, lose some sort of fitness, like, does that put them at a higher risk of injury?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. When your next grant, you know, after you study our back flexion movement during max deadlifts, that could be your be your next one. For our audience at home, just for like low back pain, injury risk reduction to the extent that that's possible, do you have like a list of like high yield targets that you would have people focus on
for low back pain prevention? Sleep. Although as soon as you tell people to sleep more, you decrease sleep. That's the problem.
Sure. right.
So trick people into sleeping more.
Yes.
I really think there's something to be said for finding exercises or activities you love and focusing on mm-hmm. them. I think there's a subset of people who really thrive by not trying to fix themselves anymore, right? Where you give up on fixing, you actually start fixing yourself. It's a bit ironic. You know, that person who did those exercises every twice a day for, you know, a year, I think that gets in the way. It's like hearing a dripping in the background. If you focus on that, perseverate, that's all you can hear is dripping. And then you start hearing dripping when there's not dripping. So there's something about like just focusing on things that you love, and that should be your target. Yeah. And instead of having less pain, it's, your goal is lifting more or training 4 days in a row and those type of ideas. Yeah. That's just like with pain being so complex and it's a system, it's such a system. It's just be better at everything you can do. It's that sort of that halo type of treatment as well. You know, spending more time with your friends after COVID or whatever, just all these things that make you healthier can help with pain. That's the wonderful thing about pain being so complicated. That means a lot of things can help you.
Yeah, that's typically the way we frame that is folks are often looking for like the one, again, the lesion. They're looking for the one source of the problem. And if we can get people on board with the idea that there are multiple things that can impact their pain, then suddenly that becomes a good thing because they have lots of things that they can work on. And for people listening who want to know kind of what our recommendations are and what kind of things you can aim at from a health standpoint, we have an article on our site for like, where should my priorities be for health? And we definitely discuss things like sleep and nutrition and social connections and all that kind of stuff are all a big piece of it. And they can all help you if you're experiencing pain. And so I like those answers.
speaking of folks in pain, so rather than like a risk reduction sort of take, someone's got low back pain, your high yield targets with respect to management.
So if it's acute, again, like don't overtreat. Know it's normal. Just because you have a massive amount of pain doesn't mean that there's a massive problem. You get strange symptoms like bowel bladder issues, priapism, like any type of plumbing issues, pain down both legs or neurological symptoms. Absolutely get that stuff checked out. But most things are non-sinister and not a problem. And although you feel like hell, you can feel fantastic 5 days later. So I tend not to over-treat at the start. That's always my biggest advice.
That means stay off the internet, kids. Very cool. All right, Greg, this has been excellent. We could talk for a long time just about funny stuff and also clinically related stuff. But for people who want to find out more about you, if this happens to be the first time, they've been living under a stupid rock and they don't know who you are, where can people find more about you?
My website's greglehman.ca, and then I'm on Twitter at that same handle. Oh, and on Instagram, but that's mainly just me doing flips.
It's my is entertaining.
Hey, neither of us can do that. So
no, we just do like deadlifts and squat and bench press. That's our Instagram feed.
Just go on a trampoline; it helps a lot.
Yeah. And you have a podcast, yes?
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. I was guest hosting and now I'm like a permanent guest host.
No, he's got a podcast, NAF Physio Podcast. And again, he's on Twitter, all the social medias. We'll link all that stuff in the description below. Greg, any parting shots for the Barbell Medicine crowd? They're, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are going to potentially hear this at some point. So, you know, this is your time to shine.
I would just say to keep listening to you guys.
Oh, man.
We didn't even pay him to say
that. We didn't even pay him for that. I got to set up, what's your Venmo? Let me tip this guy. Very cool.
All right, that's a wrap on this week's podcast, episode 131 with Greg Lehman. I've linked all of his social media details and contact stuff in the description below. So if you're interested in following him or learning more about what he does, check out those links. Wherever you're getting this podcast from, if you can leave us a 5-star rating and a review, really helps drive traffic to our podcast, which is helpful because apparently there are podcast rankings. Who knew? And now that I know that we're being ranked, well, I want to move up the rankings. So if you could do that, share it with your friends if they would be interested in this information. Share it on Facebook. You guys can get in Facebook arguments. And, you know, that's probably a good use of your time. No, I'm kidding. So anyway, we appreciate you listening. Check us out next Monday. We've got a special edition podcast with Alan Thrall. And see you then. Have a great week.
how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save